This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Blue Cliff Record, Case 96. Zhao Zhou's Three Turning Words, Part 2. Zhao Zhou expressed three turning words to his community. A gold Buddha does not pass through a furnace. A wood Buddha does not pass through fire. A mud Buddha does not pass through water. The gold Buddha. A gold Buddha does not pass through a furnace. Someone comes calling on Tsuhu. On the sign, several words. Where is there no pure wind? So the other day I gave a talk on the mud Buddha, not passing through water, in which with each of these, Zuido, who compiled the Blue Cliff Record, wrote a poem for each of these Buddhas. I was thinking yesterday evening, last night, when all of you came in yesterday, finally arrived and the Zendo was full. I was thinking of January winter sessions in the past. A little bit smaller. entering as we are into our 40th year on Trimper Mountain. And so I was thinking of watching the rock grow, watching the growth of the Sangha, not just in numbers, but in all kinds of ways. The comment about the oat milk yesterday made me think of when I was the cook my first year in the winter, first winter here, I was called to a meeting which looked very serious with Dada Roshi and the treasurer of the board, and I think Kyoto was there, about three or four people, and they talked about the budget for the winter, which they didn't go into details, but I could tell it wasn't looking good. And they said, is it possible for you to cook for the Sangha each week on a budget of, and I don't know what, it was some preposterously small number, you know, like turning, is it fish into loaves or loaves into fish? Anyway, and they said, can you, or maybe, is that, did I miss that entirely? So so they said, can you do that? And I said, I honestly don't know. And I said, but I'll try. And they said, try. At that point, we were actually getting a lot of donated. We used to go down to Al's, Boyceville Market used to be called, I think, Al's Market, and we'd pull up around the back and they'd offload these cartons of rotting vegetables. I don't know what else to call them. That we brought home and made food with. So anyway, but we got by. I was thinking if I'd known about oat milk, we probably would have had it every day. So, but it, you know, the seasons, I mean, the used to be quite changeable here in terms of people coming and retreats and sessions, and so winter was a tough time for quite a number of years, and then when that started to level out and be more consistent was nice. And so also we're looking at, as another sign of that, of imminently, of retiring the mortgage on the temple, which will also be a very significant departure of a monthly burden, and but also really significant in its showing that that we have made a home there in Brooklyn, and that we can now rest a little more easily, and really put that money into a lot of work that needs to happen there. So these are all signs, really, and that are not just, you know, material signs, but it's all connected. In the commentary, Yuan Wu says, if a mud Buddha passes through water, it'll dissolve. If a gold Buddha passes through a furnace, it will melt. If a wood Buddha passes through fire, it will burn up. What's difficult to understand about this? Then he says, Zuedo. So Zuedo compiled the Blue Cliff Record with koans and verses, and then Yuan Wu, a person in the lineage some years later, wrote commentaries and pointers for each case. And so he says, Zuedo's 100 examples, 100 koans of the collection, of eulogizing the ancients are complicated with judgments and comparisons. Only these three verses directly contain the breath of a person seeking the way. These three verses on these three Buddhas. And I always think when, you know, in these koan collections, like, where do these teachers, what do they place as the first koans and what do they place as the last koans? Always seemed like that would be significant to me. And so a gold Buddha is gold, for crying out loud. It's made of the finest materials. It's the most expensive Buddha. It's priceless. It dazzles the eyes. Everybody wants to have this Buddha. Everyone wants to be this Buddha. And yet, even being gold, it'll pass away. It will lose its luster. Great though it is, it won't pass through the furnace. Why? Yuan Wu says, well, because it'll get burned up. What's difficult to understand? But with that understanding, nothing changes. Our world remains exactly the same. We remain exactly, our views remain the same. Our attachments remain the same. So clearly, Zuedo and Chaozhou is speaking on a different plane. Some traditions, human beings are said to be made in the image of God. That's not bad. Homo sapiens means wise person. It's the privilege of getting to name your own species. Why not shoot for the moon, right? A real Buddha, remember Zhaozhou said after these three turning words, he said, the real Buddha sits within, which Yuan Wu said is exceedingly indulgent of him to say. A real Buddha is neither male nor female, nor any other gender. A real Buddha appears in a speck of dust and is as limitless as the sky. Today, right now, there's one sitting on your seat, breathing your breath, looking through your eyes, possessing enlightened nature, perhaps having raised Bodhi mind, having the heart of Avalokiteshvara. And whether that wisdom and compassion in bodhicitta is dim or bright, whether it's close at hand or seems far away, the results are in that all of that is present within you. That has been verified by the Buddha and by countless Buddhas. So the treasure house is ever present, and it appears to be locked. And there's the rub. And so, naturally, appearing to ourselves as impoverished and destitute and in need, oh, in need, we go looking for riches to adorn ourselves with. Now, I've often thought of the universality of human nature and the spiritual or religious impulse, that impulse towards what? Towards something and away from what? From something. And I don't know how it is in every tradition, in every culture. Certainly I don't know that, but it seems that over and over again we see this fairly widely held sense of isolation, estrangement. We know that we are alone within our own experience, that no one can actually experience what we are. We can have sympathy, we can have empathy, we can try in many ways to relate, there are all kinds of giving and taking practices within Buddha Dharma, exchanging selves. And all of those are doing what? Helping us to see that the self is not what we think it is. It is not a thing at all. There is a sense of something, and we misunderstand that sense and turn it into something that we take as our riches. It's sort of like the clothes rack that we're going to hang all of our wonderful clothes on. That sense of loss of something, distance from something. Whenever something appears again and again within one person, we should take notice. When it appears again and again within a group of people, within people, we should take notice. And so if we're moving away or trying to heal that sense of isolation and estrangement, that it seems at the same time that there is a fairly universally held sense of something that we call the absolute, we call God, we call union, we call coming home, we call liberation. And because of that, there's a search. We seek. And so with little understanding, with little skills, without a path, without a guide, it makes sense that we would go trying to bridge that gap, trying to enrich that poverty by whatever's at hand. And so that's what we do. We just take up whatever's at hand. And so whether it's ideas or things or identities, status, fantasies. And yet what every seeker who has gone deep, Buddhist and otherwise, has said in their own way, in their own language, testifying to the universality of this experience, that when we embrace that poverty, or rather recognize that our search for union through the adornment of things only makes us more impoverished. It crushes our soul. Then when we actually embrace true poverty, what we speak of as the death of the self, that nothing compares with that. There is no other riches. And its nature is nothing can compare with it. And that while many things will satisfy us for a moment or two, that this does not fade because it's not made, it's not created, it's not bought and sold, it's not something. But without that experience, we will naturally, inevitably, turn towards whatever we can and take those moments of satisfaction for satisfaction. When that's the experience we have, and that's the experience that basically we are building on, so have more moments, have bigger moments, we take that for happiness. And it is. They are forms of happiness. And they also disappoint us reliably. We take this person seeking as our original self. Until the moment when we have sufficient doubt, when we've had enough experience, and if we've been paying attention, we have sufficient doubt that must at the same time have some rising of faith, which is an extraordinary thing. Because with just doubt, we just become cynical. But with some measure of faith, that doubt is strengthened into something alive. We call it bodhicitta. That doubt and faith which work together in this are seeking to examine beyond, look within. And that hopefully, even though we don't have full faith in this yet, we have some faith that we are not going to find what we're looking for by just having fancier thoughts, more elaborate ideas. It doesn't mean that we're not going to continually look back and try and find something, make something of those. But that I have to think that people who are sincerely drawn to Buddha Dharma have had some glimmer, if not more, that that's not the path they're looking for. Now we're going to understand why an inferior material, a mud Buddha, a wood Buddha, would not pass through. Like I said before, they're just not made of the right stuff. But a gold Buddha. And there are references in the teachings to different grades of practitioners, inferior, middling, superior. What are we to make of that? Given that all beings have Buddha nature, all beings have one essence. I remember, you know, many times listening to Dada Roshi talk about non-striving and, you know, goalless practice. And I thought, well, that's easy for you to say. You know, I'm hanging on to my goal until I get it, and then I'll be more than happy to give that up. Each and every being has one nature, one taste, one consciousness. But we are not born the same. We are born of the same nature, but we're not born the same. Our karma is not the same. Our conditions vary widely. And so all of the actions that brought us here, and, you know, if any of us tell our story, we'll pull out highlights, things that sit in our mind as having been instrumental or important, and they are. But there's no way you can do that kind of accounting. It's impossible. All of those actions that led us here, experiences and influences and decisions and conversations, circumstances, family, neighborhood, school, friends, parents, teachers, all molding, 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 shaping, shaping, influencing, teaching. And we take all of that in as being about ourselves. I mean, that's what self-clinging is having that sense of a separate self, being separate from everything, seeing the world all around us. The self becomes self-referential. It sees itself in relationship to everything else. And that's why it is that it's such a predominant experience to have that sense that the world is happening to me. Why is this happening to me? Why isn't this happening to me? And the Buddha said, that's a very nice expression of delusion. And a very universal one. And that when we begin practicing, all of that karma, all of those influences are continuing. They don't stop. And then we begin practicing. It's all in motion and continues. And now it just continues in new ways within the three treasures. And so we're continuing to create karma, continuing to generate all kinds of consequences that are constantly feeding back and informing us and guide, teaching us and influencing and impacting us about this one, and about you. And as with any endeavor, you know, we can, you know, anything we've done, you know, we can look around and see people who seem to be just naturally inclined or have a kind of natural ability towards certain things. You know, when I was studying mathematics, there were people who seemed to have a very natural ability. I wasn't one of them, right? I had some, maybe enough, but I had to work pretty hard. And I saw other people who, like I said the other day, it's like if I had some of that, I could use some of that, right? I could use that. You're not using it. Give it to me. When I was in music, it was the same thing. There were people around me that seemed to have a natural ability with their instrument, with music, with performance, with composition. I didn't see myself as being one of those. I had some. And we can see that in practice, that some people seem to have sort of take to meditation more easily. There's just Buddha mind, but karmic minds are different. Some move faster than others. There's different levels that we enter into practice with in terms of faith, in terms of trust, in terms of energy and effort, in terms of just our physical bodies, and whether those are presenting challenges to us or sort of opens the door wide. And students with some of those natural abilities, some of them will work very hard, be very diligent, and use them well. Some won't. Some will use them a little bit, and some not much at all. Some people may come into practice having come from lives or circumstances or states of being that seem to create a lesser kind of inclination, make it not as easy as it might be for others. And this is all just, you know, from our expert positions perspective. And some of those people may be very diligent and really use well what they have and cultivate what needs to be cultivated. And some people will do that in middling amounts and some people not so much. And so when these references to, you know, different grades of students, there's nothing intrinsic about that. I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, you know, traditionally in terms of karma and rebirth, you know, arriving at a, in this life, in a more developed state because of past lives, I mean, that would be a Buddhist understanding. A way of explaining, you know, how people land in this life and then what they do with it. But all of that, in a way, is not that important, really. We make it so much more important than it needs to be. And when we make it important usually in all the wrong ways. We make it important in a way to use against ourselves. Judging from the outside is always going to be faulty. Because judging has to be from the outside, first of all. And we're using our own measuring stick, right? We decide what is the measure of superior and inferior based on what we want, what we value, what we think, or maybe what we possess or what we don't possess. But it's, again, self-referential. We cannot know another person's mind. When you realize mind, you realize Buddha mind. You know the mind of every, not only every sentient being, but every thing in this universe. Because there's just mind. But we cannot know the karmic mind. So when we judge, we can't know their inner experience. And so when we see someone and we judge them, we don't know how to judge them, really. Because you have to look at a person in terms of their whole life. Not just what do you see in this moment, but where have they come? And so you may see something that in your mind doesn't sit very large, but within the context of that person's life is heroic. We may see something that is seems very sort of neutral or timid in terms of that person. It is tremendous courage, but we can't see that. And so when we look around the world and see the world in terms of different kinds of Buddhas, mud Buddhas, wood Buddhas, gold Buddhas, we don't see the person. We don't see the Buddha. That's for damn sure. We don't see the mud, wood, and gold even. What we see is our mind. In each of these commentaries, Yan Wu has brought forth stories from the records to illustrate. And so, a gold Buddha does not pass through a furnace. He refers to this in the poem, a gold Buddha does not pass through a furnace. Someone comes calling on Tzu Hu. So Tzu Hu was a teacher. And outside the gate to his temple, he had a sign. And the sign said, Tzu Hu has a dog. Above, it takes people's head. In the middle, it takes your belly. Down below, it takes your legs. If you stop to talk to the dog, you'll lose your body and your life. And then whenever he saw somebody coming up the path, he would call out, "Watch out for the dog!" And as soon as the student turned their head, he'd go back in his room. If you stop to talk to the dog, you'll lose your body and your life. I was talking about this the other day with the story of Huika standing in the snow, cutting off his arm. These stories that are really talking about what do we hold most dear? What do we most want to hold on to? What do we most want to not lose? And so we come into practice and we just want to be looking in the eyeballs of enlightenment. But we're looking in the eyeballs of delusion. Because that's our mind. And we need to become very adept at looking into those eyeballs, of recognizing what we see. We can see and not recognize. I mean, that happens from the very first moment we start sitting. We're seeing many, many things that are happening right there, right then, but we don't recognize them. It's okay. That comes in time. And so part of what we have to become very adept at is our clinging. What do we not want to let go of? Our youth, our health, our looks, our brilliance, our good humor, our sexuality, our love, our loves, our career, our power, our democracy, our earth. But in seeing and recognizing, what do we see out of our attachments? When we cling, does it bring that closer? Does it? When we hold on to safekeep something, does it make it safe? Is that what we actually see? Does it ensure that good that we're looking for? The Gold Buddha does not pass through. Being a Gold Buddha, there is no grasping. There is no grasping at things. There is no grasping at sensations, feelings. There is no grasping at ideas, at beliefs, at judgments, at views. There's no grasping at all of our opinions and all of our agendas. There's no grasping at consciousness. There's no grasping. Within each of those aspects of the skandhas, do you see you? Do you find you? In each or any of those aspects of the skandhas. That's the shot in the dark of those opening words of the Heart Sutra. The whole earth trembles every time we chant that. The ocean splits apart. Buddhas turn. And so Tsuhu says, this dog's going to take it all. If you stop, taken. Now, having lost that which you hold most dear, what remains? What is losing your body and your life? There's a case in the Wu Men Khan that says when you have a cart, a well-made cart, and the axles, the wheels, the sides, the floor are all taken away, what's left? What remains? It's that idea of loss that haunts us. That is the shadow in front of us that gives us fear each moment when we let go more and more. That's the fear that arises when we experience a deep and true sense of stillness or silence, and we become anxious. And we agitate our mind. We go looking for something. But as before, when all is lost, nothing is missing. You know, one thing that might help is just remembering that in the teachings, that one of the things that is always necessary to be true is that what the teachings point to and bring us to has to be in accord with our actual lived experience. And so the teachings can't be trying to take us in a direction that is some kind of annihilation of anything. Right? All of these masters lived in this world. in their body. Letting go is not an idea of letting go. Grasping is not an idea of grasping. They're moments, embodied moments. They're alive. Something's happening. They arise. From what? We say desires, intentions, understanding. But do you see the desire? Do you know your intention? Is it showing you your understanding? When we finally lose our body and life, we realize it's never been any other way. It's that sense of delusion that keeps us in the dark on a bright, sunny day. And so what's to be done? Come back. All of these stories in the Lotus Sutra, all those stories of wandering, going across hills and valleys, wandering to different continents, losing everything, always and only to return back to the place where you began. Just put nothing before you. We shouldn't underestimate the power of what we are in the midst of. You know, because it only becomes clearer with time, you know, meditation, Zazen can seem, you know, like it's a practice, it's a technique, it's a thing. You do it, something happens. It's like kind of like an exercise. But if that's true, why when you begin sitting, why during Sesshin, does the top come off? If it's just a technique and an exercise, move your muscles a little bit. Why does the earth begin to shake? What's that about? We are in the midst of something. All the time. But practice brings you into the room. And it sets things dancing. And as things begin to shake, we have to learn how to dance while shaking. Why does a gold Buddha not pass through? The power of a question. And so he asks, because we might not know. We might not see what's before us. We see it and we don't recognize it. We might not truly grasp the reality of what we're in the midst of. And so we might not realize the depth and the truth of life is dukkha, of impermanence. We might not truly appreciate and understand the vastness and the wonder of this life. And so we might wander all of our days. We might, like a frog, we might just leap from one lily pad to the next looking for flies. Not realizing that it's not necessary to struggle. I remember every time I heard my teacher say that, it was like, oh, yes, I want that to be true. And so these great compassionate masters would call out in the darkness, watch out for the dog. To rouse us from our sleep. They would ask difficult questions that we're not trying to tweak our intellect, but we're trying to go right into the belly and disturb us, unsettle us. So that we walked away a little less at ease within our dis-ease. To raise the doubt, the great doubt, which is not self-doubt. It's doubting samsara, It's doubting the plan, the strategy, right? The bargain that we've made, our secret contract with our life, with the world. It's doubting all of that. And then that faith, it is not necessary to struggle. Others have realized this to be true and spoken from that place. But to walk that path means we will encounter that disease. If that doesn't happen, we're not walking. The Buddha said, between heaven and earth, I alone am the Holy One, the Honored One. Whitman said, I am vast and contain the multitude. William Blake said, to see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. I would say an instant. You'll lose your body and life. These words are the expressions of being liberated of body and life. And so we need to, again and again and again and again, an infinite number of times, an uncountable number of times, so just stop counting for crying out loud. Give up, lose, notions, discriminations, everything we grasp at. And only you can do this. Only you. Nobody can do that for you. We hear those words, but do we hear them? And in letting go, in true non-grasping, it's not you that is let go. In real losing, nothing is lost, but nothing is gained. Because that is not true and it's not needed. The world, heaven, infinity, eternity, is no other place, no other time. It appears in a piece of dust, in winter rain, in hunger in your belly, in that which is sitting on your seat. Where is there no pure wind? Suedo asks. And the comment on that says, you go this way too. Above the head is vast and boundless. Below the feet is vast and boundless. I also say, it's arrived. So many steps taken, so many miles covered, all to return where we, not where we began, but where we have been all along. And so, this limitless, vast, and boundless path we take up through right understanding and right thought and right speech and right action and right effort and mindfulness and livelihood and concentration. We take it up while we're standing. We take it up while we're sitting. We take it up while we're eating. Lest in that vast and boundlessness we get lost in the idea of it. And so that along the way, the very idea of transformation is transformed. William Blake said, every night and every morn, some to misery are born. Every morn and every night, some are born to sweet delight. Some are born to sweet delight. Some are born to endless night. Every instant, someone is being born. To misery, to delight, to daylight, to a moonless night. Once Suhu went in the middle of the night into the toilet and he called out, "Thief! Thief! Get the thief!" And he bumped into a monk and he grabbed him and says, "Got him!" And the monk says, "No, master, it's not me." And Suhu says, "It is. You just won't own up to it." We just won't own up to it. To what? To having Buddha nature? To being the one that is needed? To having all that is necessary? In a poem to the in the Womankind, woman, one of the lines is, "The troublemaker, after all, is you." All along. I think that's what William Blake is talking about. We can trouble ourselves in this moment into grief. We can troublemake ourselves into peace, into patience, into generosity, into faith. Troublemaker is the creator, the destroyer. It's the one sitting in the palm of your hand. And so don't be shy. Be that troublemaker. Be that thief. Stop and talk to the dog. Don't run past. I was remembering when I used to go on a lot of cross-country bike trips, particularly down south. Country dogs in the south are a certain breed. Three legs, one eye. Usually something pussing. And they were mean. And they would come after us. And I remember going down the straight road. And honest to God, I saw a dog come out from the house and hide behind a bush. And just, you know how they do when they get their legs and they're like just ready to fly. And he's just waiting for us. We're like sitting ducks. And so I called back to my friend. I said, "Kelly, move it." And so we just cranked it to just try and fly by at the speed of light. It was a contest. I was not yet ready to stop, talk to that dog. Step by step, day by day, leap by leap. It is in this way that we express our gratitude. I'll let Teresa of Avila end it for us. "Let nothing disturb you. Let nothing frighten you. All things pass away. God," I would say Buddha nature, "never changes. Patience obtains all things. Those who have God, Buddha nature, lack nothing. God, Buddha nature, is enough." Amen.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.